So this is a talk that complements, in some sense, what Julia told us this morning. It's focused on the genomic side of influenza evolution and what we can learn from the meanwhile quite abundant sequence data on this process. And this is joint work with a graduate student who is now at Imperial College, Natalia Strelkova. So let me just remind us that influenza is actually, apart from its impact on health and its importance for that reason, it's a wonderful system to study evolution, because we have by now quite diverse information on this system. We have sequence data. The viral genome consists of 8 segments. There's complete genetic linkage within the segments, so there's no recombination within segments, but abundant reassortments between segments. And that's believed to be important for the evolutionary dynamics of influenza. There is, at least for part of the genome, there is sequences available over a time span of 40 years now. This is, if you will, a macroevolutionary time span. There has been multiple substitutions, say, in the viral epitopes within this time span, and the relevant part of the genome has exchanged a quarter of its nucleotides in that period. So it's really, in that sense, macroevolutionary time spans, and we can observe these time series in the wild over this period. There's an enormous rate of evolution. We're going to come to this in a bit more detail in what follows. There is information on protein structure. So this is our cartoon of the viral protein, which has, in particular, we're going to talk about one of the surface proteins, hemagglutinin, where most of the antigenic adaptation is taking place. And there are viral epitopes containing the receptor binding site, and these are the primary loci of interaction with the human host and with the human antibodies. We saw already other cartoons of this morning, and this is why this domain of the hemagglutinin protein in particular, the epitopes, are very interesting loci to study the genomic basis of antigenic adaptation.
Is this the entire hemagglutinin that you're showing us there, or is this just a piece of it?
This is the HA1 domain of this hemagglutinin, and then part of this is the viral epitopes. So there is sequence information, there's protein structure information. There's also, we could call it phenotypic information. We can measure interactions between strains in sera, and we can convert these interactions into a picture how the antigenic characteristics of strains are evolving over time. And what I've done here is I've taken these strain serum interactions, regard them as vectors, and constructed a strain-strain distance metric on the basis of these antigenic interaction data. Several people have done this in different ways. But what you see here is when you, this is again ordered roughly by time. So this is 1968, and this is 2006. And when you look at the similarity between strains, then you recognize that this is progressing in a slightly more punctuated way than the sequence evolution. This has been first discovered by Derek Smith's group in 2004. And you can see that you can indeed define time intervals, which they define of an order of 3 to 5 years on average, where the antigenic evolution is somewhat slower. And then there is points in time where it appears to go particularly rapidly. But you can also see, of course, that this is not a black and white picture. In fact, the antigenic evolution within one of these clusters is of the same order of magnitude than the jump between clusters. So it's not a black and white picture. And you can see, you can to some extent choose whether you want to put in 10 clusters here in this time interval or 5 clusters. This, as in any clustering, is basically a matter of definition. But there is something a bit more rugged in this antigenic course of evolution than in the underlying sequence course of evolution. But so this is one of the characteristics of influenza. And people were very interested how this comes about. And there's basically two explanations for this pattern that are around. One is that for one reason or the other, selection itself is concentrated in certain years. So there is less selection going on here during one of these clusters. And then selection acts during one of these cluster transition and drives this antigenic characteristics to, say, the next level. So one way to imagine this, this was in a paper by Katja Kölle and co-workers, was that there is a neutral search that the antigenic characteristics, the epitope characteristics, have to perform a neutral search in this space. So not all mutations are immediately beneficial, but only after the right combination of mutations has occurred, then a new beneficial variant is found. This takes a certain amount of time. And then a selective sweep happens. And this defines then this next transition. So this is one way of generating the time dependence, the effective time dependence or punctuativeness of selection itself. Another explanation would be that it's pervasive epistasis. So it's, again, a characteristic of the selection, not unrelated to the previous one, because the previous one is also just described to you as a case of synergistic epistasis, that it's, again, it's the right combination of mutations that have to come together, and that this takes a certain amount of time. In fact, I'm going to question both of these explanations as we go along in the talk. So we want to also understand why this pattern happens.
Would these explanations also explain that on the sequence level, the evolution is not so punctuated?
Well, it depends how you look. Let's look at the sequence data on the next slide, and then we can discuss that. So here is what you can see at the sequence level. So it became, with the availability of these data, many people have constructed trees. And this is one example of an influenza strain tree. So it's based on just under 2,000 strains between 1969 and 2006. So it covers indeed nearly 40 years. And you can see here that as the tree progresses, it has this very characteristic one-dimensional shape. So it's always diversity is generated on small time scales, but then it's always very efficiently pruned. There's no speciation. There's always one strain and its descendants that survives, and all others go extinct. The coalescence time of this tree is of the order of 3 to 4 years. So when you draw a line at any year here, then the last common ancestor is rarely ever more than 3, 4, or sometimes 5 years in the past. The color coding here is the year of strains, which is the observed year for those strains that were actually observed. And for the internal nodes of the strain, you can reconstruct the year. And you can see that this goes in a quite consistent way, a quite linear way. So there's limited sequence diversity. There's a single lineage. But it's also clear, and we demonstrate this as we go along in the talk, it's not a neutral coalescent. The important thing, however, it is this strange tree should be thought of as a coalescent tree under selection. That means that when you take two strains here in a given year, they form a they can interact with each other by competition. These are the ones that are present in a given year and may have fitness differences and so on. It's not a phylogenetic tree where the elephant and humans and the chimpanzees are at the terminal nodes. That's nearly a triviality, but it needs to be stated because it affects the way we can infer selection from this tree. So that's what I mean here by the branches of these tree are coupled by selection. The ones that you see in a given year are, at least potentially are, modulo population structure, geographic separation, and so on, are in a common selection pool. In fact, it turns out, and studies, several studies in recent years have shown that on these medium time scales, the tree is geographically well mixed. So we can, in first approximation, think of this as one population. So,
I vaguely recall waves spreading out of Southeast Asia. So, in those trees, so different samples come from. So presumably there is therefore some temporal substructure,
right.
Spatial temporal substructure, as it sweeps from, I don't know, jumps from Europe to South America.
That's very true. So it's really, it's of course, as any of these population structure effects, a matter of the timescales which you look at this. So these, this dynamics takes place on a scale of months. On the other hand, when you draw this tree, where sort of the information is given on a yearly time basis, then if you look at a given neighborhood of the tree, so a given space in this similarity of sequences, you find sequences from several different continents. This is in that sense. So it's not, while you can order this tree quite well by years, and years are separated here, you can see here, this is the cloud of 1 year. If you try to do the same thing with space, you color the things by continents, then things would be quite sprinkled on much smaller scales.
But to the extent that there are multiple points corresponding to a single year, do I have to worry that which ones are actually staying in Southeast Asia and which ones are samples from Australia and therefore so sort of dead branches right there?
Of course. I mean, this is like this recent papers, Eddie Holmes and co-workers, for example, they have looked at dynamics of this sort. And what is, it's not completely clear where exactly sources and sinks are. There are a bit diverging opinions, and maybe we'll hear more about this in Catherine Macca's talk. But to the extent that there is a source population, then anyway, the interesting dynamics would be mostly going on in this source population. Mostly what we see is then transported out from this by migration. So that's certainly one scenario that we would have to keep in mind. However, even if this is the case, then the spatial problem would be to some extent reduced.
I agree, but I'm just sort of trying to understand to what extent, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you buy out of Southeast Asia model, then all we need to do is sample
in the China and will be done, right? But in practice, these sequences come from all over the place?
In practice, they are undersampled from China. Of course, this has political reasons, not scientific reasons. So. Anyway, for the purposes of these studies, we have assumed on the time scales of years or so that these migrational dynamics have essentially mixed. This is, of course, we can question that. So what we can do with this phylogeny, we can also map, by maximum likelihood, we can map mutations on the tree. And this is here done. This is for synonymous mutations. You can see exactly those mutations that appear on the backbone of the tree or trunk of the tree. So this single lineage that connects past and future. Exactly those mutations are substitutions. And all the other ones are polymorphisms that are essentially lost, eventually lost in the population. If a mutation appears on a branch here, it will be around for a while, but then it will go extinct of the order of, the maximum time scale is of the order of 3 or 4 years.
So what's the difference between blue and black in that figure?
These are just, this is dark blue, and the ones that are substitutions are highlighted here in a slightly brighter blue, and this should be brighter red. It doesn't really come out. So this is non-synonymous. They have formed three classes here: synonymous mutations, non-synonymous mutations outside the epitope. You can see there are a few substitutions, but much less than expected. We're going to come back to this in a moment. And non-synonymous mutations in the epitopes. And so you can see that there is about 100 in these 40 years that appear as substitutions.
How long is the epitope again?
So this is the set that we have taken here of known epitope sites. That's about 60 codons. So
an epitope? Or was that epitope?
That is the okay. Epitope that we took as epitope sites.
But you're looking at the five classical epitopes for HA1, is that right?
Yes. So here, we didn't try to be fancy in predicting sort of some codons that are under positive selection, because that for individual codons is very noisy. We took here a conservative set. This may mean that we miss part of the substitutions that are relevant for antigenic
You may be able to back extrapolate to define the real epitopes based on which mutations are strongly selective.
Have tried that. But of course, this is noisy, as I said, for individual codons, because you have of the order of one substitutions going. You have 100 substitutions in the entire known epitopes over 40 years. So if you try to, so that means there is a few mutations per codon. That means any prediction of where you have a surplus of non-synonymous over synonymous substitutions on a single codon basis is very noisy. Moreover, there could be effects, and people have argued that the relevant codons shift over time, so something is maybe for 10 years a positively selected important part of the epitope that then becomes unimportant. So we have tried not to do this here because we don't want, so our goal was not to predict here new relevant antigenic sites, but rather to look at the statistics in a conservative way. So what you see is when you just now plot the number of substitutions per year between 1969 and 2005, the number of yearly substitutions, you see it's highly fluctuated, and it's clustered. And it's clustered in all three of these classes, importantly. So you see here, I've here drawn here a relatively arbitrary scale. Say every year with eight or more fixations is a fixation cluster year. And this is marked here by these dashed lines. And you can see in these years, not only the non-synonymous epitope mutations are elevated, but also the neutral synonymous ones and even the non-synonymous ones outside the epitope appear in these substitution clusters.
So the part of the genome you're looking at, is that in one of those non-recombining parts?
Yes,
of the genome?
That's this HA1 domain. It's about 1,000 base pairs. About 60 codons is that subset of the epitope codons, and the rest is the non-epitope part. Yeah, for the purposes of
this. So for the purposes of it, there's no recombination. So if one fixes,
there is no. So we have looked at this, and it's known there is no sign of any recombination in these data. So the genetic linkage is perfect. So it's 98% of what you would expect under complete no recombination. There is a slight, sometimes there is multiple originations of the same mutation in competing clones. This reduces a little bit genetic linkage, but overall it's nearly perfect. So that means a mutation occurs in one given clone, but it doesn't get transported to other clones by recombination. So, and as expected for these, so we think of these as selective sweeps, and a selective sweep should prune the diversity in sequence, and indeed you can see that the years where these fixation clusters occur go along with a pruning of the diversity. That's nothing surprising, and you can see that sometimes these things are shifted by 1 year, because a fixation occurs when all the competing clusters are extinct, but the pruning of diversity may be a little bit shifted in time towards that. But you can also see that it's not a complete drop of the sequence diversity, which is of course an effect of multiple mutation. The winning clone produces its own mutations while it's sweeping through the population. So there is new diversity generated already during the occurrence of the selective sweep. So you can try to put this on a bit more quantitative basis. You can say if you now take a distribution of the number of fixation per year, then you can see this again. There are many years with just 0 or 1 substitutions. Here there are our cluster fixation cluster years, and there is an underrepresentation of years with an immediate number of fixation. So we are, and there are these fixation clusters, and then there are years where not so much happened in terms of fixation. Of course, this is very far from a Poisson distribution. You can write down several measures of this, but this is clear to the naked eye.
So the dash is what you would expect?
The dash is a Poisson distribution with the same mean,
yeah,
which is what you would expect if these substitution events were independent. But of course, this is, so it's a classical pattern of recurrent selective sweeps, which is well known for this system. The question is, what causes these selective sweeps? What's the underlying evolutionary mode? And that's what we're going to examine now.
But so, just one comment, that's what some people would call over-dispersed molecular clock, right?
Yes.
That's
one of the characteristics.
That pretty much almost any system, right? It's not influenza specific.
This is not influenza specific. I mean, this is a quantitative pattern that we can now try to explain in a different way. It's clear from these data, that evidence, and that's quite undisputed also in the community, that there are selective sweeps going on. Now, of course, the fixation cluster years here at the genomic level show a strong correlation with the antigenic transition years. So that's a pattern which can be mapped to the antigenic pattern. The question is, what kind of mode is behind it? And in order to discuss that, let's first have here one slide where we try to develop a measure that will be just nice to plot things. So we can try to look for fitness effects of mutation. And they are, this is here, a selection coefficient between two strains, say with sequences A and B, and that's just a fitness difference. That's well defined at a given point in time. However, in our dynamic scenario here, the fitness landscape is not a landscape, it's changing itself because the human immune host pose continuously new challenges. Then there's the whole population dynamics. We've heard aspects of this in Julia's talk this morning. So the competition between these strains changes the fitness landscape for each of them. So it turns out that when you want to plot, say, fitness as a function of time, this is not even a univalued function, is not a good measure. What remains a good measure of this process is what you could call the cumulative fitness flux. And what we want to plot as a function of the tree, for example, I show you plots the next slide, is just the sum of all selection coefficients of all the mutations that has happened, say, between a common ancestor at the origin of the tree and a given strain. So you can think of this as the time derivative of this cumulative flux as a measure that people in clonal interference studies use a lot, namely the speed of adaptation. So this is just the, so here we sum up all the selection coefficient, and if you take the time derivative of this, then it would be all the mutations that take place with their rate multiplied by their selection coefficient. So when you...
Just a quick comment. So most population geneticists would normalize S, and it seems to use an unnormalized S.
What do you mean by normalize?
Okay. F of B minus F of A divided by F of A.
No, these are Malthusian fitnesses here, so there's it will be just the difference in growth rates per unit of time. This has dimensions 1 over time. So this would be one. So now, if we take this measure, and I've taken now, I've enhanced the tree and plotted it three-dimensionally, and the vertical axis is just this cumulative fitness flux. So we start somewhere in the past, and we ask for each strain, what is the sum of all the selection coefficients of all the mutations that took place until we arrive at that strain, and that's plotted as vertical axis. So if we are in a complete linked scenario, as we've argued there is, there's I think little dispute about that, then we know from theory, we've heard many talks in this workshop on this topic, that there are essentially two regimes that we have to distinguish. The first is what you could call punctuated selection, or periodic selection, as it's often called in the clonal interference literature. That's when the population is small, or the mutation rate is small enough so that beneficial mutations are rare. The supply of beneficial mutations is low. And then each beneficial mutation carries a selection effect. If it overcomes genetic drift, it gets fixed. And then in this case, there may be a neutral search. And at some point, maybe there's the next beneficial mutation. It gets fixed again, and so on. So that's the picture that we have already discussed, that people are also discussing for influenza. However, you can see that this picture has a logical condition for being consistent. That logical condition is that the sweep time is much shorter than the search time on one neutral network. Well, why is that? Because if you find, say, you search here for 3 years, and then you find a beneficial epitope variant, well, you would probably, if you find the first solution after 3 years, you would find the second solution after 4 years. So what we need to have in order this picture to be consistent is that the sweep of the first mutation has already been completed before the second solution of this problem has been found. Because this sweep depletes this lower the populations searching here in this space, and a new search is then started. So that's the picture of punctuated selection. If that condition is violated, if a second solution is found before the sweep of the first one is completed, then you have two competing beneficial mutations, and we enter the regime of clonal interference.
You said if the first solution is found after 3 years, and the second one we found after 4 years, it seems like...
All I wanted to say is, if you have a complicated search space, right, then the time it takes to find the second solution is of the same order of magnitude. That's a reasonable assumption than the time to find the first solution.
So that's not so obvious to me if we're talking about complicated neural network.
So you can certainly make very different models of epistasis.
Well, especially since we're seeing diversity increasing over time, right, after one of these sweeps. So the sweep happens, diversity increases. Mm-hmm. So you could say that by the end, when it's found the first solution, the population is occupying a much larger space of the neutral network than it was for the previous part of its evolution. So the second one should happen right afterwards.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly... but what you're arguing is that the times should be even more similar, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing special about the first solution. But this picture requires that the sweep is very fast, so that the second solution never matters. Now, if this is not fulfilled, then it's not a radical change of the picture. We have still neutral searches and so on, but this is now the picture when that condition is violated. So here, there are two solutions found at a similar point in time, and then these are competing clones, and we have a classical mode of clonal interference. We still may have neutral searches, we still may have epistasis, but this goes on in subpopulations for limited amounts of times. So the population is now still finding solution, but it may find solutions at similar points in time, and then beneficial mutations that have overcome genetic drift are lost. And that's the very definition of clonal interference. So, and just one corollary to this, this is so far, this was just abstract pictures, clonal interference leads to massive hitchhiking, we know that, and it leads to a clustering of fixation times. So the question that I want to ask now, which is the regime that influenza is in? So this is, and these two regimes are not distinguished by anything very fundamental except the supply of new beneficial mutations. The question we want to ask is that supply of beneficial mutations high enough so that they start to compete or not? So we need to try to infer how much beneficial mutations are there.
Do you need interference there at the bottom? I mean, in the previous picture, wouldn't you also have massive hitchhiking and clustering fixation?
Well, it depends on what you... maybe massive is not quite well defined. But so all I wanted to say is what you have alluded to already. So we get a clustering of fixation events for a clonal interference process that is at least qualitatively similar to what I've shown you already from the influenza data, without making any particular further assumptions on selection. That's all.
You also get it for isolated sweeps too, right?
You also get it for isolated sweeps. However, it would be. I show you the differences between the two scenarios. That's good. But qualitatively, this is correct. So the way we decided to infer selection is using the wealth of information that we have for this system, namely the time series of allele frequencies. And in particular, we can define the probability for one polymorphism that is found at one time t to be found at a higher frequency x in the population at some later time. So we call this probability the frequency propagator from some initial frequency xi to a final frequency xf. And in a rational similar to the McDonald-Kreitman test, we form ratios of these propagators between one of the selected classes, our red and green polymorphisms, the non-synonymous ones inside or outside the epitope, and the neutral, nearly neutral reference class of synonymous polymorphisms. The reasons are exactly the same as in the McDonald-Kreitman test. These ratios are more robust under various biases in our data set. So, for example, if the polymorphisms at one particular frequency are over or under counted, then this bias in counting, this possibly frequency dependent bias in counting, is taken out by forming a ratio. So this is more like a practical matter. And what if you do this, what do you see? Well, you see, let's look first here at this red curve. We form this ratio of probabilities of starting at some low frequency and ending up at some frequency x. So here on the horizontal axis, there's frequency, goes from 0 to 1. And you can see, and this is normalized by the probability for synonymous substitution. So the blue ones, the synonymous polymorphisms, are here at 1. This is just our denominator. And you can see that the probability of reaching some appreciable frequency for the non-epitope, non-synonymous polymorphism is drastically reduced. It's only about 30% at for substitutions at the final end of their trajectory.
So, can you give a little more details of how you arrive at these numbers from the sequence data? It's not clear to me how you get to g of x from sequences.
Well, you have the entire strain tree,
yes.
So we can look at each year how many of the strains have a given allele at a given point of the sequence. So we can directly measure the time series of these allele frequencies. And that's the input data. So we have all these time series, and then we just count. So we have so and so many blue lines, and how many of them? They all start at some low population frequencies, and then we measure which fraction of them reaches a certain maximum frequency. As you recall from this tree, this line, most of these lines go up to some population frequency, and then they go down or lost. And some of these lines end up with population frequency ones. That's exactly the ones that are on the backbone of the tree.
So where does the xi go? Do you not care about the xi?
The xi is the initial population frequency. Now, it turns out that upon forming this ratio between two classes, that initial population frequency essentially drops out. So it doesn't matter. So we find any polymorphism, it starts somewhere. It's first found in one strain. So its initial population frequency is always low. And we just ask, what is the probability of ending up at a higher population frequency? And upon forming ratios, one can show that the exact, this is one of the sort of things that this measure is robust to, the uncertainties in the initial population frequency. Because, of course, this is nothing intrinsic to this data set. This is when we see this mutation first, because somebody has sampled.
A simpler way to say it is just to count how many, say, synonymous mutations reach frequency 0.6 and how many non-synonymous mutations reach frequency 0.6, and then you take the ratio of those two.
No. We form a double ratio like in the McDonald-Kreitman test, right? We say the probability of starting out and then reaching something, the probability for each mutation, for each single mutation, divided by the probability in the neutral class.
You correct for the fact that there's more neutral ones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So the relative frequency of those that reach 0.6.
Right. Okay. So, but you can also see that unlike for systems with independent sites, this probability, that this relative depression saturates pretty quickly. And this represents, of course, the fact that we have selective sweeps, right? After a polymorphism has reached a population frequency 30%, it's essentially its fate is decided. Either it's in a bandwagon of a selective sweep, then it will also be fixed, or it's already discarded by negative interference, then we never see it at that frequency. So it's the flattening of these curves is already a manifestation of our sweep dynamics.
Sorry, can you explain again? So I don't understand the figure. What? So on the x-axis is the frequency.
Yes.
Initial frequency? No.
No, it's the final frequency. No, it's the frequency at which we observe a polymorphism. Right? We just ask, what is the probability that the polymorphisms in the blue class and the green class, say, reach frequency x, divided by the probability that a blue line would reach frequency x.
So, to the far right of the figure is the probability of fixation.
Yes.
Right, so the green ones are twice as likely to go to fixation.
Yes.
And the red ones are?
The red ones are 30% as likely, so they're strongly suppressed. So that's, of course, that's well known. All I've told you in some sense, all I tell you so far is in some sense well known. So at least 80%, or sorry, at least 70% of all non-synonymous changes outside the epitopes are under negative selection.
So G of 1 is something like omega, the ratio of synonymous to non-synonymous evolutionary rates, right?
Right. And conversely, in the epitope, there is a strongly enhanced rate of substitutions. So at least 45 of the 80 epitope non-synonym substitutions are strongly beneficial mutations. So the rate is enhanced by a factor 2.3. And it turns out that this test is conservative under clonal interference. So under clonal interference, this enhancement measures the fraction of mutations that are strongly beneficial, that are essentially above the threshold where they're likely to be interfered with. So we get a, as I would argue, conservative estimate of the number of beneficial mutations that drive this adaptive process. And you can see already from this number, if you multiply this number 45 with an average time to fixation of the order 2 or 3 years, also for these beneficial mutations, also for the epitope mutations, you get something of order 90 or 100 years. But we have only 40 years, so these beneficial mutations have to overlap in time. They have to compete. There are too many as to fix them with their known fixation time sequentially in the interval of 40 years. So that's already the first strong signal that these beneficial mutations overlap in time and therefore have to compete, actually, that we are in the scenario of competing beneficial mutations.
Can I read the red curve as saying that only the neutral non-synonymous mutations outside the epitope ever reach frequency 0.3? And after that, that's showing the fraction that emerges past 0.3.
I'm not sure where to follow the question.
Did I say the red curve, the non-synonymous mutations outside the epitope, that its level that it's settled to after x equals 0.3 is the fraction of those mutations that are neutral?
Well, so these are the non-synonymous ones, right? So now you can, as usual with these tests, you can now say, well, either 70% are under very strong negative selection and 30% are neutral, or there is moderate negative selection on a larger fraction. But that was the statement, at least 70% are under negative selection. If you assign this signal of the 30% left ones entirely to neutral ones in that class, then you get a lower boundary for the ones under selection. But then you could also have all sorts of mixed scenarios. So that's beyond the power of this simple counting, of course.
with this propagator rations that you found, doesn't time also come as a parameter there?
Well, we could use time. The reason why we decided to not use time here or integrate over all time, so we just use time ordering, right? So it's always like the initial point is always earlier than the final point, but we don't ask about the time delay that has happened. And this has, again, just a data reason, because the origination time is something that is often comes with a large error bar, because we don't really know when exactly that new mutation originated. We know when it's first observed by some CDC in some new isolate, but of course it could have been around at low frequency already for a bit longer. So that's why we chose here to integrate over the time. In other data sets where the time information is better, or maybe now with more exact sampling of the system, we would of course take the time in.
So does this method give you distinct results from if you were just using standard Goldman-Yang model and fit it to the sequence data, which is what most people would
do? Exactly what, yes, this is exactly, I think this gets annoying. So. Somehow I could turn this off, but I don't know how. Anyway, so I'm going to come to this on the next slide. So what this means in terms of the tree is enhanced rate of substitution means that a much higher fraction of the green dots is on the trunk and a much lower fraction of the red dot is on the trunk compared to the total number of points. So this is very simple, sort of in all what I'm telling you has very simple geometrical interpretations on the tree. So, and this you can see here with the naked eye, so there's about five of these substitutions over these 40 years here, but about 80 to 100 here. So, I think I have to do something about this. Somehow this can be turned off, right? I know what I can do. I can turn the airport off. Maybe. So now let's do something that probes clonal interference more specifically. So let's ask a different question. Let's ask the question, what is the probability that a polymorphism first reaches some frequency x and then afterwards get lost? This is, again, we can count this very simple given our time series data. We just have all these time series. We ask what fraction of the blue time series first reach, say, 60% and then get lost. And we can again form ratios of this between our selected classes and the neutral reference class. And what we can see in particular is, if you look at the green class here, so this is significantly, remember this is a logarithmic scale here, above 1 for extended frequency intervals. So what does this mean? This means that there is a higher fraction of trajectories, of green trajectories, so epitope, non-synonymous changes, that reach a substantial population frequency, but then are lost. So that, if you will, is a verbatim translation of clonal interference. There are just many of the trajectories of the type that we've seen in many of the talks on experimental evolution, frequency trajectories that go up to an intermediate frequency that is well above the level of genetic drift, and then are discarded. And this test does nothing but quantitatively measures this from this data set. So what we conclude is that there are beneficial mutations which are lost because they are outcompeted. They are initially successful, that's why these green trajectories reach in a higher fraction than others' intermediate frequency, but eventually they are lost. So that's one example why this sort of more quantitative methods on based on time series play out here against the standard population genetic tests. What does it mean? I claim that everything I say is trivial on the tree. So what does this mean? Well, it just means you find more green dots, not only on the trunk of the tree, but also close to the trunk of the tree, right? So it means the green dots are overrepresented here in the vicinity of the trunk. Because these are exactly the ones that have a substantial subtree below them. So if you have one here, it can reach all the subtree. So that would be a substantial frequency. But we know eventually it's getting lost. So all what we have done is we have measured the green dots graded by their distance from the trunk, if you will. So time is getting close to an end, so, but I want to sort of briefly ask the question, what would be a minimal model for this genomic influenza evolution? Of course, to make a real model of influenza is a horrendous task, and we heard from Julia this morning the complexity of the epidemiological side of it. I want to here make a complementary approach, ignore that mostly, and take the genomic side and can say, well, this pattern of genomic data, genomic polymorphism data, can we make a simple model of clonal interference or not that is consistent with these data to corroborate this inference of clonal interference? And so the model that we decided to do is we have selection coefficients at individual genomic sites in our hemagglutinin sequence. And in order to create a non-equilibrium state, we mimicked the change in human immune challenge by selection coefficients at individual genomic sites that from time to time flip between favoring one allele and another allele. So this obviously, each of these flip, if you think that before the influenza had the preferred allele, would create a new window of positive selection and would trigger adaptive response. And in this model, the flip rate of selection is a way to trigger, to control the amount of new beneficial mutations. So it's clearly, if we open new windows of positive selection, we create many more, we create windows where the system wants to adapt. We can ask the question whether it can adapt.
Are these flip times dependent on the time that the allele has been there? Or?
Here we didn't take that. So we just took this as an outside way of driving this system away from equilibrium. So this would mimic, say, a change in the human interaction with the epitope that, for example, would say, okay, here, before an A was good, now you should have a C here. And so this model, you know, that this is so simple, it doesn't even have epistasis in it, which of course we could build in, we have built in one more elaborate variant, but let's stick for the moment with this one. So then there is, so this is the time-dependent selection, there's genetic drift, and there's point mutations, and we can run this model, we can do strain-based simulations of this model.
Sorry, you flip at different sites.
We flip at different sites independently, okay. And just so roughly every flip per codon is roughly every 30 years. So per codon it's rare, but of course we do this in several codons, and then we can trigger this rate, and this is how much task we give the system to adapt. So it's basically, if you think about it, it's pretty much the simplest extension of the Fisher-Wright model that would give you like the possibility of reaching a clonal interference state. So if we do this with a sufficiently large value of these selection changes, we can actually map quite quantitatively these data. That's not so surprising, right? We need to, as soon as we make this gamma big enough, the system is completely linked, we introduce competition between clones, so we need to produce these trajectories that first go up to appreciable frequency well over their establishment frequency and then go down. And what we've done on our population genetic test, of course, there's nothing but measuring these. So we get, so the data is these squares, and actually this solid line is the model. I forgot to say this was already on the previous graph. So this is the model, and this is the data, both for the sort of ratio of propagators and for the ratio of return propagators. If we make the rate lower, that go out of clonal interference and into the episodal or periodic selection regime, where sweeps are rare, where you have extended waiting times between sweeps, then, well, you get something. Let's look at this graph. Then the propagator ratio for beneficial mutations for positively selected one is drops drastically. That means we do not see return trajectories as we see under clonal interference. So this is a population genetic test for clonal interference, if you will. It precisely picks up these trajectories that first go up and down. So it's a much more quantitative way of looking at these data than, say, just the tree shape. Because as there was a question already before, the qualitative shape of the tree would be far less sensitive to whether we are under periodic or selection or under clonal interference. It would always be pruned by selective sweep and hence look roughly one-dimensional. But if we look a bit more in detail at the statistics, we can actually distinguish these two scenarios. So that's one of the messages that I wanted to get across, that one can do more with these data than just shapes of the tree.
What is the time scale for the gamma that fits the data?
Well, as I said, it's about, in this model, it's about one every 30 years for each codon. So for each codon, if you had only one codon by itself, it would be the system would have no trouble adapting to this, because there's a flip, and then maybe a year later this adapts, and then it would stay for a while, and then the next flip. But of course, since you have many codons coupled by linkage, it has a hard time to cope with this adaptive demand.
So, Michael, when you do this fit at this level, do you just need one beneficial sigma, or do you have a distribution?
We have a distribution here, but this is so qualitative that it is not very sensitive on the distribution, as it shouldn't be, because it's designed to be just a test of whether or not clonal interference is there in a data set.
Michael, as I recall, you said you had 60 codons, so you're getting about a flip every 6 months on average.
Yeah, we get something like that. So this is roughly the demand of substitution that we need to impose on this model system. So let me quickly ask one more question. So 30 seconds, right. Given that there is this, if we accept this conclusion, that there's a high supply of beneficial mutations, enough to create clonal interference, what do we learn about influenza? What are the biological implications of this? Is this more than just a sort of a population genetic interest in the system? So in order to this, let me go back to what we can measure about this system. In particular, let me recall to you the definition of the fitness flux, which was the time derivative of this cumulative fitness flux. And this has, again, this is used by many people as a measure of speed of adaptation. It's nothing but the rate of epitope substitution. So in our case, we evaluate this for the epitope, the rate of epitope substitutions multiplied by their average selection coefficients. If you integrate this over time, over a long time, you will get again this cumulative flux that I've shown you already projected on the tree. And as a second measure, we use the degree of adaptation. So this is just how well influenza is adapted to the momentary selection. This is just a measure of genetic load. And it's very simple. It just says how much is the fitness away from the fitness minus the fitness of a complete random genome divided by the fitness of a completely adapted genome minus the fitness of a random genome. So this is just a normalized version of genetic load. It means that if this is one, you have a perfectly adapted genome. And if it's zero, it's basically a genome that is random with respect to the momentary fitness landscape.
I was wondering, what is random? So any random genome is probably dead, doesn't do anything.
Yeah, so alpha shouldn't be too low, right? So alpha should be 1 minus something. And we can study this now in the model, right? Because in the model we know exactly where is our preferred allele.
Random genome with respect to these loci that you flip.
Random genome, so random just means I choose the allele randomly, right? Then I get on average as many sites that are at the favorite allele and as at the disfavored allele. Suppose I have just two alleles per site. So this is, of course, this should not happen in a viable system, because then the genome has no information with respect to selection. So you expect always to have more fixed states at the beneficial allele, so this alpha should be significantly above zero. So we can study now how these measures depend on, well, whatever we like to in the model. Here we chose to the rate of immune challenge. So we change gamma, and we ask how these quantities change. So here's the degree of adaptation in the epitope. It goes down. Well, this is what happens, because the fitness flux, the speed of adaptation, goes up, but it goes non-linearly up, sublinearly up. That's the well-known fact that under clonal interference, the speed doesn't grow linearly with the maximum possible speed, which is here proportional to gamma, to our flip rate. So, and because the speed of adaptation grows only non-linear, the degree of adaptation has to go down. So the system is compromised at any point in time by its linkage, which just that means that not all beneficial mutations that should happen actually take place. But what is perhaps the most interesting thing is it's also not very surprising from a point of view of clonal interference, is that also the degree of adaptation in the non-epitope part goes down as a function of due to these recurrent selective sweep, and that's just the effect of deleterious hitchhiking that goes on also in this region, which has nothing to do with the antigenic adaptation. So the important message, I think this is a biological message that I think we are at the beginning of understanding, is that this process that we think of usually on a genomic basis, clonal interference, introduces an interference between biological functions. So we can think of this on a larger level now. And so antigenic adaptation and conservation of other viral functions, say protein stability, they interfere with each other. They mutually limit each other's success. And that, of course, resonates with what Julia told us this morning about integrating this into an epidemiological model. So that's clearly a direction that we should take. So we conclude that the adaptive process and the conservation of other functions, if they're linked by genetic linkage, should not be thought of as two distinct entities, but they are tightly coupled to each other. So that means we cannot understand the influenza adaptive process from the antigenic data alone, because the fitness of a virus is not determined only by its antigenic phenotype. So what we should conclude, well, this is speculative, obviously, but we could predict that hemagglutinin, a protein that is under particularly strong antigenic challenge, is actually more brittle, is more compromised in its stability than maybe other proteins of influenza. This is something that we could try to test. So, last U graph. You can also manipulate something else in the model, not in the real system. But we can ask, what happens if you just make the genome longer of influenza? Right? We just put another 1,000 non-epitope sites. So we don't make the epitope longer, we just make the conserved part of the genome longer and run the model dynamics. So what happens? The degree of adaptation in the epitope goes down. The fitness flux, the speed of adaptation, goes down. We don't see a strong effect in the non-epitope part. So what this means is yet another aspect of the same coupling. If you just add non-epitope part to the genome, you can further hamper the adaptive process in the epitope just by the additional background selection that is introduced by a part of the genome that has nothing to do with antigenic adaptation.
What is the thick circle? Is that the real system?
I forgot to mention this. This is the data points that correspond to where we think the real system. And we just took this influenza calibration point. This is the one which we used for matching the polymorphism data and varied the model to the left and to the right. That's what we did.
Why doesn't it recombine? That would help.
So we could speculate that maybe the segmentation of influenza genome has evolved at least partly so as to limit the deleterious effects of linkage. Because of course, between the segments, there is frequent reassortment. So all this dynamics here that we see in the model is one linked segment. And we know that is true for each of these protein segments. We explicitly checked it for this hemagglutinin, that there's no recombination whatsoever, but I think that's consensus. But of course there is, and people have shown that there's frequent reassortment between the segments. So partitioning the genome into relatively short segments helps the adaptive process. This is what this model thing does, shows. So, in order to get what is left of Bein and Sheese from the other people, let's conclude. What I wanted to show you is we have strong evidence from these genomic data that influenza evolves by clonal interference, which explains the punctuated pattern without specific assumptions on selection. So that's the picture that we associate with the influenza tree. It's a tree that climbs up its time-dependent fitness landscape, not as a single line, but with parallel trials, some of which are successful, some of which are not. That's what distinguishes it from the punctuated pattern that would arise at lower beneficial mutational supply. I want to stress once again, it's not a transition of principle, it's just a transition in the number of beneficial mutations, and we have evidence that with influenza we are in the interference regime. And secondly, if this process goes on, we should think of its functional consequences, and here the consequences appear to be that adaptation and conservation are tightly linked. Thanks a lot.
Can also be a certain effect of adaptation more directly by shifting immunodominance at the level of epitope presentation?
I mean, there can be many things, right? If you sort these two proteins to some new combination, people believe that this is one part of the causes for pandemics, right? If you have a particular, so possibly most of these reassortment combinations are deleterious, but then a few ones may be new beneficial combinations, and they would present a higher fitness increase that leads to a sort of pandemic event. But that's a very much an active matter of research at the moment, what these reassortment processes actually do.
I appreciate that you want to keep the population dynamics simple, because this is already quite tricky. But so one step towards it might be these flips aren't independent of what's going on with post-immunities. The strain's been around for a while here, flips. And a first approximation to that might be that sites flip at the same time.
Right.
Because the strain's been around for a while, immunity right. builds up, so actually it's time for right. it's time to shift. Because it's, so if you correlated sort of right. the effective gamma, would that do anything different?
I think it would. It depends on what you're looking at. So we did actually, we made a model of this sort, a simple epistasis model, where essentially we correlate the success of one flip to how many flips have been going on before since the last sort of successful ones. And you can match the influenza data as well. The reason why I didn't emphasize that is that already the simpler model matches the influenza data, so we can't add at the current data density new statistical significance. We just add necessarily more parameters to the model. We can still fit the data, but we could fit the data already with a simple model. So I think this tells us two things. First of all, if you want to infer epistasis, this is a very tricky subject in the presence of clonal interference, and we should carefully discount the hitchhiking effects of clonal interference. So correlations between fixations are not by themselves any proof of epistatic interactions. They are probably there. They're just difficult to disentangle at the current data situation from drift. The other thing we have tried is we have taken a epistatic model which has punctuated selection. So we have taken exactly a model that describes the scenario of neutral searches plus rare sweeps, so that only one sweep takes place at a given time. And we've checked that that model cannot explain influenza data. So again, if you have an epistatic model, say neutral networks plus searches, it can perfectly well explain the data once you make the findings of new solutions so dense, which of course you can control, right? What is the beneficial, the number of solutions that you put in your neutral network where you can trigger sweeps. And once they overlap in time, we find again our signal in our propagator ratios. If we keep the epistatic model in the non-clonal interference regime, then we don't find our data. So in short, we have at the moment used epistatic model only as negative control models, because already a non-epistatic simple model can give us matching with this kind of data. But of course, the data are getting better by the day, so we should be able to discriminate epistatic models from simple models pretty soon, and that's going to be exciting then, because then it gets closer to the biophysics of these interactions. Time for wine and cheese.